Welcome to HackerRank Radio, Episode 3. I'm Vivek, co-founder and CEO of HackerRank. Each month, we're going to talk to top engineering leaders about solving one of the toughest problems today, hiring the right developers. Today, I'm excited to have Gail Lockman McDowell, founder, CEO of CareerCup. You may have probably heard about the website. She's also published a book, Cracking the Coding Interview, Cracking the PM Interview, which is the number one book in the interview category at Amazon. Welcome, Gail, to HackerRank Radio. There is a lot of debate on the coding interviews right now having algorithm problem-solving skills, and you don't necessarily use those data structures in your real-world coding. You don't use a try, you don't use a linked list. So why use that during the interview process? How do you reconcile the two?
You know, I think this is rooted in an assumption that interviews should be realistic and that the more realistic an interview is, the better it is. And I challenge that a little bit. I think the point of an interview is to hire. Therefore, a good interview is one that is predictive and, you know, good candidate experience too. But yeah, the end goal of an interview is to predict who you want to hire, who would make a good employee. That is what you should really be focusing on. If that happens through a realistic interview, fantastic. If you somehow create an interview that is nothing like the real world, but is also predictive somehow, that would still be a good interview. Be strange for that to happen, but that would still be a good interview. So with data structures and algorithms specifically, there are definitely times when companies go too far in the wrong direction and start asking candidates for, you know, to implement Dijkstra's algorithm and all this other stuff that is not actually real world. It's also not predictive because all you're really testing is someone's knowledge. You know, when you stick to basic computer science, when you stick to basic design and algorithm, they should be there if an interviewer is doing the right thing to essentially assess the candidate's problem solving skills. To simplify it, their intelligence. And problem solving skills, intelligence, that is actually a very, very important thing for a developer.
That statement is hard to debate. Problem solving and intelligence is very important. But would you say that it's across the board in terms of irrespective of whatever seniority, because there's also this whole thing of, hey, if I'm a new grad, I'm just used to solving all of these problems, I'm going on a lot of these sites, but if I'm working at a company for over 10 years, I should still know the basic data structures, but I've not solved those specific problems anytime in the recent past. So do you think it is applicable across the board?
Pretty much, yes. I think companies need to adjust their expectations, but I'd argue for almost any job that requires analysis of any sort, whether it's programming or not, intelligence is pretty important.
Yeah.
It's not everything.
Yeah.
You don't hire somebody who's brilliant and has never written a line of code to be a programmer. But intelligence is really important, really useful across development, across lots and lots and lots of jobs. Where things go wrong is where companies look at these questions as, let me see if the candidate gets them right. Let me see if they know the answer. When companies do these interviews well, in order for them to do it well, they need to ask questions that candidates haven't solved before, that are challenging, that are challenging because it's actually a hard problem and not because it tests obscure knowledge, and see how the candidate solves a hard problem.
I see. So you're more concerned about their thought process.
Yes.
How they deconstruct the problem and how they solve it block by block.
Yes, exactly. And it's when I interview a candidate, I don't sit there with a timer and say, okay, my best 25% of candidates are the ones who solve it in, you know, the shortest 25% of time. It's about how you move through that problem. Can you move through it? Can you make progress on it? And there might be candidates who, you know, there's a bunch of steps to the problem. They get stuck on one piece and I help them through it. And then they do really well in the other pieces. It's a very qualitative process, a very qualitative analysis.
Which companies do you think actually do a really good job at this?
Facebook does a reasonably good job of this. I think what Facebook does is they do a good job of the process as a whole, of having a structured hiring process that's consistent, and also creating, you know, they have interview training. I don't know if it's the best interview training anywhere, but they have it, which most companies don't even have interviewer training. And they also create a lot of transparency with the candidates. And so the candidates and the interviewers and the company are all pretty well in sync about, here's the goals of process, here's what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. That is when the processes work pretty well. A lot of companies have no interviewer training, and you have interviewers who are doing a process that they don't know what to do. They don't know what the goals are.
Yeah.
And that goes poorly.
Yeah. I don't know if you remember, but we first spoke 7 years back when we were called Interview Street, and we were doing mock interviews. We were doing mock interviews, which was our first business model, which actually didn't work. And I reached out to you because CareerCup has a section, or maybe it still has a section.
We still do market
reviews. And I was just reaching out, hey, does this product work for you? And now I'm seeing just a flurry of companies that is starting to do some version of mock interviews, and you talked about interview training. Is this sort of a new trend, or how do you even look at this? At one end, it looks pretty good. Okay, I'm going to prepare candidates for the interview. At the other end, it feels like, you know, I'm going to tell you all the questions that are being asked.
Yeah.
How do you do how do you figure out the balance?
What I do as a job is really split between the two. I do a lot of stuff that's what I would call on the candidate side, not necessarily one-on-one coaching, you know, my books, things like that. That's the kind of the candidate side, bigger talks on, you know, preparing for interviews, doing well in that. And then there's the interviewer side. And you're right that there is a conflict there. It works actually very, very well for both sides of the business that they're conflicting and not necessarily in a bad way.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is when I go into a company, one of my major points with them is, look, I'm doing all this candidate stuff. If I have a question or a type of question that I can prepare candidates for really, really effectively, you know, the more effectively I can prepare a candidate to do well in that, the less effective that actually is as an interview question. And an example of this is dynamic programming.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that candidates who have very weak problem-solving skills will probably never do well in those questions. Candidates who are just okay, I've seen over and over again, give them 10 of those problems, and on the next one, they'll look like a great candidate.
Yeah.
Because they're incredibly formulaic. That makes them not a very good interview question.
Yeah, but then you should also get really good as an interviewer to figure that out, right?
Yes, or just stop asking that question. Because the problem is you need to know, if you're evaluating somebody, there's a difference between how this candidate's solving the problem when they've never done a problem like this before. If you have a candidate who's really prepared those questions, you need to ask questions much more challenging to really look at their problem-solving skills.
Mm-hmm.
Because the formula is largely the same on these problems. And so the better thing for an interviewer to do is don't ask those kind of questions. Don't worry about this, oh gosh, has the candidate prepared these questions or not. Just don't ask them. There's so many other problems out there that are going to not be as biased by preparation. But a lot of the other stuff that companies are doing to prepare candidates, whether that's companies who actually are focused on that or companies who have their own candidate prep side, a lot of that is stuff that is not about memorizing techniques. There is some pattern matching of kind of applying some techniques to other new problems. But that's true across programming anyway. There's a mm-hmm. lot of pattern matching in it. And your ability to pattern match is actually kind of useful as a programmer.
Yeah.
But a lot of the other stuff is stuff that's not, it's not about learning specific techniques, specific algorithms to apply to some new problem. It's about learning things like, hey, when you get a new problem, come up with an example. Come up with an example that's pretty large. A tiny one is going to actually not help you very much. It's about boosting candidates' confidence, things like that. In an ideal world, companies wouldn't need to do that. It would all be, you know, preparation wouldn't help at all in an ideal world. But, well, this is a real world, and there's compromises with any interview process.
Mm-hmm. And what would you say for a candidate who's obviously, you know, you're not interviewing on a day-to-day basis, clearly, if you're working at a company, and then now you look for jobs, and then the interview environment is sort of different, right? And sometimes you use whiteboards, and of course, it's stressful, it is timed. What do you think is sort of the leap that a candidate needs to make from, okay, I'm coding, I'm a very strong developer, to now I'm going to go ahead and interview? What are some of the things that the person needs to know?
So I think, you know, preparation is useful. I actually don't, despite being in the business of candidate preparation, mm-hmm. I don't tell candidates, like, go spend 6 months or a year preparing. I think that's insane. What I would tell candidates is spend a couple weeks, you know, doing a solid amount of interview preparation each week. Don't spend months and months doing it. That's silly. Know your basic data structure and algorithms really well. You don't want to feel insecure. You don't want to lack confidence with your understanding of a binary search tree or something like that. Be very, very, very comfortable with those topics. And it's better to be super comfortable with the basics than be pretty comfortable with a lot of things up to the advanced algorithms. Get really, really comfortable with the basics. And that actually doesn't take that long. And then push yourself on harder problems. That might, for someone who's weaker, that might be kind of medium difficulty problems. For someone who's already pretty strong, it might be very, very hard problems. But push yourself and get comfortable with the idea that you can solve a challenging problem.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And are all of these problems available in Cracking the Code interview?
Not all interview questions. I actually specifically tell interviewers, do not ask questions for my book, because as much as it would actually help me, I don't believe in, like, being dishonest there.
Yeah.
I would say there are sufficient problems.
Yeah.
The goal of interviewing as a candidate is not to hope that you've get asked a question you know how to solve. That actually tends to hurt candidates when that happens, largely because they're not honest about it.
Yeah.
The goal is to get better at solving new problems.
You made an interesting point. I think maybe it was one of your Quora answers or somebody was tweeting at you on, this is not a perfect process.
Yeah.
Right? And I think it was, this was an engineer who built Homebrew, the brew installation system, and he got rejected by Google because he couldn't reverse a linked list or whatever. It's some hardcore data structure algorithm. I think what you mentioned was there is no perfect interview process, and there's always has bias and flaws. If you want to expand more on that.
Yeah, I think that's something that people need to be really aware of. There's this thing people do where they're like, this process is broken for X reason.
Yeah.
That's why we should all use this other process. Well, what if that other one's even worse?
Yeah.
There is no perfect process. There's not even a perfect process for one company. There's a good enough, there's maybe as good as it gets, but it all has flaws. You'll see people who say, to take a couple processes, you'll have people who say, we should really be hiring people based on what they've done before.
Mm-hmm.
The past is the best prediction of success. Well, you're not going to be hiring somebody on what they've done, first of all. You're going to be hiring people on how they talk about what they've done. And there's quite a difference between those.
Yeah, yeah. So your presentation skills would probably supersede your actual coding skills.
Yeah. And so one of the things I do is I'll go into companies and I'll help prepare them for their acquisition interviews. And it gives me this really interesting data on how someone's interview performance matches with their actual job performance at that company.
Interesting.
Just very hard data to get otherwise.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was this guy I interviewed where I was like trying to work with him on behavioral questions. Tell me about the hardest project. Tell me about a challenge you worked on. Nothing's been challenging. It's all been easy. And it was impossible to get out of him anything challenging. And the reason why is he was actually an incredibly bright guy who'd worked on some reasonably hard things, and they're all pretty easy for him because he's extremely strong. And you can easily walk away from that interview feeling like, you know, he's just been some code monkey. He hasn't really done anything challenging. And that was totally, totally would have been the wrong impression to get, because that was not the case. Or you get people who do a really good job of making what they sound more complex than it really is.
Yeah.
You want to find people who will be good, who will be able to do cool things, not necessarily people who have.
Yeah.
A person who has been working, doing, you know, boring IT at a big company in the Midwest and, you know, hadn't really gotten any hard problems, they're not going to have a whole lot of hard problems to talk about. Someone who's a very mediocre employee at Google or Facebook might have a lot harder, cooler things to talk about. Doesn't make them better. Mm. They've just gotten the benefit of having harder problems. They might very well be worse.
Yeah. Do you think the problem-solving questions give you a good idea of their future performance?
I think they give you a good idea of their intelligence. A specific type of intelligence, but intelligence.
Yeah.
And specifically, what it does is if you conduct the interview process well, people who do well on those questions tend to actually be pretty bright. So it doesn't mean that everyone who does poorly is actually not bright.
Hmm.
But your goal at a company isn't to hire everybody who's smart or, you know, everybody who would be good. Your goal is to hire enough people who are good and as few people as possible of the bad ones. It's okay, in other words, to have some false negatives.
Yeah.
You just want to limit the false positives.
Yeah.
For the most part. So yeah, I think the process does a decent job of hiring people who are pretty smart. Now, you want to add into stuff like, don't hire someone who's bright and kind of a jerk. And you can actually get a pretty good read of that through these questions. It doesn't look at all at work ethic, ability to focus, you know, things like that. But it's actually really, really hard to get that data.
Yeah, work ethic is probably over a sustained period of time.
Yes.
Right? It's hard to get in an hour interview.
Work ethic also isn't a constant thing. You can have someone who works super hard and gets put in an environment with a manager they don't like. And all of a sudden, they're trying to check out of there as soon as possible.
Yeah, it's a function of environment,
colleagues,
manager, problems that you're working
on.
That's probably a lot of other factors. So this one, really, what you're trying to say, if I can, is this assesses the basic minimum intelligence for a developer that you absolutely need to continue the interview process or to even feel good about, okay, can I hire this person or not?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say more than basic minimum intelligence. I think it does a reasonable job of looking at intelligence on the whole. Not the person who gets a very good versus very, very good. A lot of that's kind of random. But if you do it the right way, it does a reasonably good job of ensuring that the people you hire are smart. And when you hire smart people, even if they don't know the right technologies, this or that, they can learn them. They can think about problems deeply. They can juggle lots of different components.
Yeah.
You're going to want to add on into this some behavioral stuff. You're going to want to add into it some, depending on the amount of experience, things like system design or something like that. It should never be the entirety of a company's process.
Yeah, yeah. The interview questions are super important. I've seen companies do a question which is based on a trick or just based on a math formula that you get, right? It's super, super important. And even you touched upon that. You should really focus on figuring out how this person deconstructs the problem. And it's okay to give hints. And it's okay if the person actually solves the problem with a hint. Don't ding him or her for that. How would you phrase or frame, here are the attributes of a really good question, and here's what you shouldn't be doing?
So for a kind of the algorithmic problem solving, the design and algorithm problem, there's a few major things. First thing is the question should be challenging, not in a, we're going to go ask about Dijkstra's algorithm. That's not challenging. That's expecting Ken to know a lot about algorithms. That's not actually challenging.
That you're relying on the fact that whether you know a fact or not.
Exactly. Right? And if that's all you, if you need Candace to know Dijkstra's algorithm, if it's that important to you and that you're like, no, we really need advanced graph knowledge, what I find is that most companies who make that argument, you say, okay, so if it's so important to you, you're also training your people on it, right? You know, in their first week or two.
Yeah.
Well, no. Like, well, then is it, if it's that important to you that you're going to say Dijkstra's algorithm is fair game as an interview question, then you should be training on that. If you're not willing to do that, I don't think it's that important to you, actually.
Yeah.
So one big thing is, you know, challenging questions. Questions that are challenging because they're actually hard and not because they acquire obscure knowledge. Mm-hmm. Having questions that have multiple, what I call hurdles, that can be multiple parts to the problem. So it can be a bunch of follow-up questions. It can also be just a problem that has multiple optimizations to get to the most optimal algorithm.
Yeah.
As much as possible, those hurdles should be things that are logically deducible. So no tricks, no cool math, you know, things, whatever. A good rule of thumb there is if a candidate's struggling and you're trying to give them a hint and you have a hard time figuring out how to give them a hint without giving everything away, that's probably not a good question.
Yeah.
You've just made things very, very arbitrary and rather than they get one piece. The knowledge that you do require, make sure that you really do require that knowledge. You really do need that on the job. And ideally, that should be a list that is actually communicated both to candidates and to interviewers. So if candidates are going to be asked questions about binary search trees, just give them a heads up about that and give a list to interviewers about what is fair game. For most programming jobs, I would say binary search trees, how they work, things like that, that's fair game. How to balance them, that's cool algorithm knowledge that you probably don't need, and you can probably train people on if you really do need that.
Yeah, I think this is very helpful because there's, you've almost deconstructed into, don't just blame algorithm problems, blame the bad algorithm problem solving, right? I mean, there's a general misconception in the industry, and whenever this gets on Hacker News, there's a big flame war that's going on. Oh, that process is bad, we're good, and all of those things. But I'm also curious to know if problem solving and algorithm and fundamentals, which I believe is super, super important for any developer, a lot of non-traditional developers, non-traditional in the sense you didn't go to a college and get a CS degree, but you went to a boot camp or you were self-taught, where they don't really focus on this.
Yeah.
I mean, in fact, a lot of boot camps actually tell you, you know what, I'm going to make you a really strong React developer in 90 days. And you just figure out how to build an app and then you go ahead and do it. And then you bomb the interview process and it doesn't work really well. What would be your advice to them? Or in general, what's your view on this pool is just going to get larger and larger because people are just going to learn on their own. How do you think about approaching that?
So you know, I've prepped a bunch of people who don't have CS degrees.
Yeah.
Some of those are people from boot camp. Some of those are people who are self-taught. To take a specific example, there was a friend of mine who got laid off from his job at a, you know, if you were to rank startups, this was not a like good startup. The company closed down for arguably kind of shady reasons. This is not a good company. When I started prepping him, he had never, you know, I was like, well, obviously, you know, hash tables. What? Like, no, never heard of them. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is like very, very, very basic computer science. Like, you cannot walk into these interviews not knowing this. His starting point was not knowing anything about computer science. Been programming for a long time, didn't know anything. Didn't know anything about computer science, data structures, algorithms. And his interview with Facebook was in 3 weeks. And he got an offer. And he actually did very, very well there. And is still there doing very, very well. Because fundamentally, he's a very smart person. No, he never learned computer science. He was totally self-taught, but he's a very smart person. And that is the biggest piece of what they're assessing. He had to learn some things, but it doesn't take that long to learn hash tables, linked lists, binary search trees, basic graph stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, it really doesn't take that long. The biggest thing that hurts people who don't have CS degrees is really just insecurity. This guy, he's reasonably confident. So he walked into the interview believing in himself. What I see with a lot of people who are from boot camps or who are self-taught is just insecurity. You, as soon as you ask them a question about, okay, given a binary search tree, do such and such. They're like, well, wait, hold on. I don't use binary search trees ever. Like, I know what they are, but I've never worked with them in the real world. Like, no, neither has anybody else. And they just count themselves out. And for the most part, they usually have the knowledge that they need to have.
Yeah.
And if they don't, that does not take long to acquire at all.
And do you think there's a bias from interviewers, like the posture of candidates? Or do you think it's important?
When I do interviewer training with companies, I specifically tell them, do not take into account confidence. Like, you are not looking for candidates who are confident. But if a candidate is unwilling to proceed with a problem, if they give up, if they don't try as hard, if you want to find the fastest runner in a race, and it's not all about speed here, but if you did want to find the fastest runner in a race and somebody wasn't doing their best, they're going to get to finish line slowly and you won't know how good they could have been had they really done their best.
Yeah.
And that's what happens here is the candidates, they either explicitly give up or they just don't try as hard and they don't believe that they can do well. And so they don't. It's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah. And calibration should also be hard, right? Whenever you do the interview or training for companies, like you mentioned, because people are coming from different types of companies, different sizes. Each company has their own bar. And how do you figure out, this is our bar, and here are the types of questions that we're going to ask, and here are the expected answers. That is going to be a hard challenge. Or do you think it's all echo chambers in Silicon Valley where everybody's just asking the same questions?
You don't need to calibrate across questions. When I work with companies, often they'll say, can you give me a description of what a good answer on this problem looks like? And I refuse because you can't make that comparison. You can't say all candidates must get to this point and will they get this score? Because it's much more qualitative. You know, if I ask you a question and you, I'm going to be giving you help and hints and guidance and this and that, and you can't make apples to apples comparisons there. Each interviewer really just needs to be self-calibrated.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what we did at Google, was I would give a score. And I kind of have a feel for, I give a 3 if it's a candidate who was very good. You know, a 2.7 if they were pretty good, but I'm not sure if I would hire them. But maybe, you know, and I have this gut feel. My 3.0 and your 3.0 might be different things. But when the hiring committee is looking at my 3.0, they see, oh, 3.0, that's a pretty good score from Gail. Usually she doesn't give a whole lot of 3.0s and above. So each person does not need to be calibrated across the company. An outside force can look at that and get a feel for what their scores mean.
Yeah. And are you seeing more of these hiring committees come about in different companies? I know Google was a big proponent of that.
Yeah. You see it in a lot of the bigger companies.
Yeah.
There's different models companies can take. There's the, most people don't think about it this way, but the other model that I see actually a ton of companies starting to take is bar raisers,
mm-hmm.
which derived originally from Amazon. That gets a lot of the advantages of a hiring committee without a lot of the weight of it. And that still has some of the value of the like outside person looking in. That gets a lot of the same value and allows a lot of the same calibration.
Yeah. And what are your thoughts on making a decision? Like consensus-based, hiring committee says yes, bar raiser says yes, and then it's a go. How do you think about, you know, all of these different models? Like what's the right framework to think about before making an offer?
The way I teach companies is it's not about a consensus. It's not about you have 5 interviewers and all 5 need to say yes individually. That's not really the right way to think about. People's yeses can mean different things.
Yeah.
If I interview a candidate and they showed very strong problem-solving skills, but I'm not sure, you know, when I probed a little bit at their skills in system design, they seemed pretty weak, but I only probed a little bit on it. So I'm giving a no. But my next 2 interviewers now gave very strong, really probed on system design, and they gave very strong yeses. Is my no still a no?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was giving a no because of one thing that other people just resolved that concern. So what I teach companies instead is say, we want somebody who is not a jerk. We're all on board pretty much by and large that the person can work with other people. Okay. Are they smart? Do we generally believe that? And look at it attribute by attribute of what you're looking for rather than a thumbs up, thumbs down from everybody.
So this is a question that we ask all our guests. What's the first thing that you ship to production?
So I interned at Microsoft for 3 summers and Apple for my 4th summer before graduating college. And actually my Apple work got shipped before because Apple just moved faster and deadlines, whatever. My Apple work actually got shipped before my earlier stuff, which was kind of funny. But I guess the very first code that got shipped was stuff that I wrote my very first week at Apple. I was in the iChat team, which was their like AOL Instant Messenger that I think now has been folded into Messenger and lots of other things. But I was in college and had a bunch of, you know, buddies on my buddy list and multiple accounts and this and that. And one of the things I found annoying working on iChat was every time I had to switch accounts, it was like a whole process of like signing off and doing all these different things. And so I implemented a little thing just for myself, allow me to switch, like a little menu thing that allowed me to switch accounts. Basically, just for me, and they're like, seems like, yeah, let's go do this thing. Like, it only adds value to the people who have it, who have multiple accounts. Great. And, you know, wrote my first week, whatever. Like, didn't know Objective-C at all. And then it wound up on the, like, packaging messaging material for, like, new features in, like, OS, whatever, virtual OS X, like, switching accounts. I'm like, okay, guys.
Did they put your name as well there?
No, I know. No, they're real shame they didn't.
That's pretty cool. That's a big one.
Yeah. Right? It was cool. I mean, it was a very, very easy thing to write, but it was kind of cool that it got listed on the, like, the newest features.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Thank you so much for the listeners. If you have any specific questions or topics, tweet to @HackerRank.
Thank you so much.